Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words, and I'm delighted to have as my guest today Douglas Preston. We will be discussing Mr. Preston's new book called The Monster of Florence, a true story published by Grand Central Publishing. And first of all, Doug, thanks so much for appearing on the show today.
Well, Casey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, The Monster of Florence, I'm going to tell listeners that I thoroughly was mesmerized by this book. I thought it was a fascinating blend of nonfiction, but the suspense was really breathtaking and fast-paced at times, and it's just an incredible, incredible story, one that you're probably, as an author, you'd be lucky if you come around a story like this in your life, you'd be lucky.
Yes, I think it's a unique story. When I first came across the story of the Monster of Florence, I thought, you know, this is the most amazing story I've ever heard in my life.
Now, was it intimidating, Doug, when you started to write this? Because in the cast of characters, which I really like the fact that you gave us the principal characters and the timeline at the start of the book, it had to be a bit overwhelming, I would think, when you got started with this, to try to keep the timelines and the characters straight.
Well, it was sort of funny. I fell into the story by accident, really. You know, my wife and I moved to Italy with our kids. We were fulfilling a dream. We'd always wanted to live in the hills of Tuscany, and we rented a beautiful 14th-century stone farmhouse surrounded by olive groves and vineyards. And then I learned that the olive grove outside our front door had been the scene of one of the most horrific double homicides in Italian history. And as a thriller writer, I was more intrigued than dismayed by this, and so I started looking into it, and that's how I learned about the Monster of Florence. It was an incredible story.
And Mario Spezi, when you met him, it was almost as if you two were fated to meet, because it seemed like he had gone as far as he could with the story. And when you guys met, you were able to bring some different things to the story to help move it along that he had run into a brick wall with. And it ended up becoming a very treacherous endeavor for both you and Mario.
It was. When I first heard about the monster, I encountered Mario Spezi, who was the journalist who had covered all the killings from the beginning. Now, the Monster of Florence stalked the Florentine hills from 1974 to 1985, murdering couples making love in parked cars. And then he would perform a very ritualistic and disturbing mutilation on the woman. And he'd never been caught. It's actually become the longest and most expensive criminal investigation in Italian history. So I teamed up with Mario Spezi to investigate the case, to look into it. I thought it would make a great article in the New Yorker magazine, a magazine I write for occasionally. And so we started poking around, and one of the things we found, or that Mario uncovered, was a secret FBI report that had been prepared for the Italian police, which gave a very detailed psychological profile of the monster prepared by the famous behavioral science unit of the FBI in Quantico, Virginia. And using this description of the monster, which was amazingly detailed, we were able to track down a person we thought was a very likely suspect. And we went to his house at 10 o'clock at night. We surprised him at home, and we interviewed him, and at the end of the interview, we asked him, "Are you the Monster of Florence?" And his answer was quite chilling, although unfortunately it's not repeatable on national radio.
And Doug, were there times when you felt that you had gone too far with this, and that your safety was in jeopardy, and that it'd probably be safer just to come back to the States?
Well, there were times like that. I mean, our idea of moving to Italy was that I was going to write a murder mystery set in Italy, and you know, we were going to have this wonderful sort of under the Tuscan sun kind of experience. But it very quickly became a dark experience, and I can't say my wife was all that pleased with it. You know, she more than once said to me, "Doug, you know, you're getting into this. You're way over your head here. I mean, you know, this is some serious stuff you're getting into." And you know, our lives could be at risk here, because we lived in the Tuscan Hills, in the territory of the Monster of Florence, and he'd murdered two people, you know, practically right outside our front door, so he knew the area. So, yes, I was, but I have to tell you, I don't know if this is a good admission or not, but I became sucked into this story. It became somewhat obsessed with it,
mm-hmm.
finding the truth, and it's a bit like treasure hunting. You know, you think that next hole you're going to dig you're going to strike the gold.
Mm-hmm.
So Maury and I kept going, thinking, you know, every fact we uncovered, every new thing, we thought, this is it. We're getting closer and closer to the truth here, and I believe we did uncover the truth. And
mm-hmm.
you know, I present it in The Monster of Florence. We present the facts.
Mm-hmm.
We don't accuse anybody of anything, but we let the reader see the facts and decide for themselves what they think about this case.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that while you were pursuing this, you came across what could almost be termed a pure evil on several occasions, where and the abuse of power within the system was something that is, I think, U.S. readers are going to read and be kind of shocked at some of the things that you had to encounter.
Well, the Monster of Florence investigation itself is one of the most incredible investigations in all of the annals of crime. I mean, it started off where they were looking for a lone psychopathic killer. But gradually, the investigators began, because this case was so famous in Italy, because the person who solved this case would have his career made, the investigators started arresting people without evidence, and then the monster would kill again.
Mm-hmm.
And it became almost a game. The monster was toying with the investigators that as soon as they arrested someone, the monster would kill again. And then, in a final gesture of disrespect and horror, the last killing the monster did, he alerted the authorities that he killed somebody by mailing them a piece of the victim.
Mm.
And so it became almost a game between the monster and the authorities. But then the authorities got off on an investigative track that will seem quite astonishing to American listeners. They decided that it was not a lone serial killer, but that it was a satanic sect dating back to the Middle Ages that had been operating in Florence for centuries, and they needed female body parts for their horrific black masses and their worship of Satan. And so instead of looking for a single killer, which all the forensic evidence pointed to, they started looking for a satanic sect of noblemen and professors and doctors, dating, you know, with ancient roots. And that's when Mario and I got into trouble with the authorities, because
mm-hmm.
we were saying, look, this is a lone serial killer. I mean, the American FBI profiled him, said this is what he was. All the experts, psychological experts, say this is a lone killer. All the forensic evidence recovered from the sites indicate a lone killer. And the Italian authorities did not appreciate us disagreeing with them publicly, especially when Mario went on television in Italy, because he's an Italian, he's quite a well-known journalist, and ridiculed the police's theory of the satanic sect.
Mm-hmm. And that he was actually arrested for a period of time and taken to jail. It was pretty amazing. And some of the court scenes that you described, I found it fascinating. There's just some really macabre characters that appear in the story, that some of them that I really was just fascinated with. And one of them was the Pazzi family. And then I, you know, come to read that Thomas Harris made one of the characters was kind of one of the characters in Hannibal.
Well, that's right. In fact, Hannibal Lecter himself was inspired by the Monster of Florence. Thomas
mm-hmm.
Harris was fascinated with the case and followed it very closely. He even attended a trial of one of the suspects who was acquitted and took notes. And so the Monster of Florence had a tremendous influence on Hannibal Lecter. You know, I felt when we went to interview this fellow, I thought, gee, this is like interviewing Hannibal Lecter.
Mm-hmm.
He was the real Hannibal Lecter.
Mm-hmm.
It was intimidating. But I got to tell you, the thing that really made me realize that I was in over my head and I'd fallen into the story was one day I went out in the morning to get my wife a cappuccino to bring it back to her and, you know, in the house, and my cell phone rang. And I answered it, and this voice speaking Italian said to me, "This is the police. where are you? We are coming to you now. Don't move. And it was the police. I thought it was a joke at first. And I have to tell you, my wife did not get her cappuccino that morning.
Yeah.
And I was hauled in for an interrogation and subjected to the third degree and accused of being accessory to murder, of perjury, planting false evidence, all kinds of crimes, and basically told to leave Italy.
That's incredible. And is that the way you're handling it, Doug? Is just you're just going to stay stateside at this point in time?
Well, I was thrown out of Italy. I left with my family, within 12 hours. I didn't want to. And then the State Department called me and they advised me, please do not return to Italy because we don't want to deal with your arrest. You're in very serious trouble.
Yeah.
And I had to hire a lawyer, and I spent many thousands of euros on legal fees in Italy trying to clear my name. And it is true that I have managed to get a lot of the charges against me dismissed. They were so patently false that, but still, there's still new charges coming, and the corrupt prosecuting judge who initially ordered my interrogation and Mario's arrest is on trial himself for abuse of office in the case. So that was a turn in our favor.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my legal troubles in Italy will go on for a long time.
Interesting. Doug, there was a great line in a book where one of the Florentinians says, to a Florentine, 20 years is the day before yesterday. And as I was reading the story, it does seem that time moves at a different pace over there than it does here in the U.S.
Well, it does. Florence is an ancient city, a beautiful Renaissance city. It's really the birthplace of the Renaissance, and in many ways it's the birthplace of the modern world. Not only did the Florentines sort of invent architecture, well, they didn't invent it, but they, brought it into the modern age, architecture, music, mathematics, science, astronomy, but they even invented the letter of credit. Florentines created the modern banking system with the invention of the letter of credit. But since the Renaissance, Florence has remained exactly the same. It's a city frozen in time, and the Florentines are very closed people. Most of the rest of Italy thinks of the Florentines as being very, closed and arrogant and haughty, aristocratic. And it is true. This is the way they are. And they have a different sense of time than we do. Time is frozen. Florence is a Renaissance city, and even the Baroque architecture in Florence, the buildings built in the 16th and the 17th centuries, 18th centuries, the Florentines dismissed that as new construction.
Doug, I was interested stylistically. You tell the book in two parts. Part one is the story of Mario Spezzi, and part two is the story of Douglas Preston. And what was your thinking when you broke it up into the two parts? Was that just the easiest way for you or the most interesting way for you to tell the story?
Well, it was. I was trying to. It's a very complex story, stretching back half a century even. The first murder that was, connected to the Monster of Florence case took place in 1951. And then there was another murder in 1968, murders between 1974 and 1985. And then even accusations of murder after that. People committed suicide who were accused of being the Monster of Florence. And there's still people on trial for being members of the satanic cult. So the case goes on today, and I wanted to make it a gripping story for the reader, almost like one of the thrillers I write. And that seemed the best way, starting with the story of Mario Spezzi as a young journalist, covering the first murder, arriving at the scene, and absolutely stunned at the murder scene, which he said was like a museum diorama. Now, he was a crime journalist, so Mario had covered many murders before, and he said, the scenes are always messy, the signs of struggle, everything's chaos, frozen chaos. But he said the Monster's murder scene was perfect. It was almost like it had been arranged. He said it was so cold and clean that you wouldn't have known it was a murder scene until you saw the dead body, or the two dead bodies. And he said that was the most chilling thing about it. And the Monster was a very organized killer. The FBI report said that he did not choose his victims. He chose the place. He decided where he would kill his people. And then he would wait there like a spider at night for the lovers to arrive in the car. And even before the lovers had arrived, he had mapped out the entire killing from beginning to end. And it was just like a choreographed event. And so he only left the clues that he wanted to leave, and he never left any clues that might lead back to him. He was truly a diabolical killer.
Yeah, that is chilling. And I think there's a sense that a person that does that is going to get caught. And a couple times in the story, you do think that the monster has been caught, but then he just plays with us by murdering when the other person is in prison. It was absolutely diabolical.
It was. Most people who commit murder are not that smart, and it's a messy affair, and they often leave clues. You can't commit murder without leaving some of yourself at the murder scene and without taking some of the murder scene with you. Even the monster Florence couldn't do that. But these murders were almost as perfect as you can get in real life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Doug, when did you feel that you wanted to put the book to rest and write the story? Was whenever you kind of felt that you and Mario had an idea of who the monster was, and that you could then put together the book? I would imagine it was hard to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, this is when we're going to start wrapping it up. The book works brilliantly.
Well, thank you. It worked like this. We started out writing a piece for the New Yorker magazine, and we finished it and was accepted for publication, and it was scheduled for the third week in September 2001 issue.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, 9/11 occurred, and all the issues that were planned after that for the New Yorker were completely changed. So we instead much later wrote a more updated version, or I did, for the Atlantic Monthly. And then Dateline NBC saw that article and thought, this is an amazing case. So they did a show about the monster of Florence. And in fact, they even interviewed our suspect. He wouldn't appear on television, but they did. Were able to interview him off screen, in which he said some outrageous things. That Dateline NBC episode was something else, really. And then we said, we'll turn this into a book. The monster has not been found. He's still at large. But we do believe that we provided enough of a resolution, enough of a feeling that, yes, this person could very well be the monster, that I think there's a feeling of closure at the end of our book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought so, too. And, Doug, what is it that I know that it had to be an exhausting book to write. Now that you're out talking to people about it now, the thing you're happiest about with the reaction you're getting from the readers?
Well, the most important thing is that I tell a good story.
Mm-hmm.
If it isn't like a gripping book that keeps you turning the pages late in the night, then I would have felt that I had failed. You can give readers all the information they want, but it isn't a good story. At least for me, I like a book with a great story. So the readers have been saying to me, wow, I started this book and I just couldn't stop to the end. I was up till 3 in the morning. I love hearing that I've deprived readers of sleep.
Sure.
So, and I also feel that I've contributed something to the, something interesting. This is a story that's never been told in English, although it's a famous story in Italy, and it's well known in England, in Germany, France, and Europe, but it's never been told in English.
Yeah, and I found that fascinating because I read a lot of crime and keep my eyes and ears open, and when I read this, I kept saying to myself, I can't believe I haven't read more about this story.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting. I got a call from Christopher McQuarrie, who is the screenwriter who wrote The Usual Suspects.
Oh, okay.
And he won an Academy Award for that. And he said to me, this is the most incredible true story I have ever encountered.
Mm-hmm.
I want to write the screenplay. And so he bought the rights.
Beautiful.
And he's doing the screenplay, and the production company is Jinx Cohen, which produced American Beauty.
Oh, beautiful.
So it's a good team. I have high hopes that this will be not just another Hollywood film, but something really interesting.
Oh, that's great. I'm so happy to hear that. Delighted to hear that. Well, Doug, I want to congratulate you on a wonderful book, because when I started it, at first I thought I might be overwhelmed with this. There's a lot of characters, there's a lot of timelines, a lot of things moving back and forth, but you kept it right on track for me, and I was just absolutely mesmerized by it. So thank you for both an entertaining read, but also I learned a lot about history as I was reading it as well.
Well, thank you, Casey. I really appreciate your good words. I'm glad you like the book.
And for listeners, we've been discussing The Monster of Florence, A True Story, written by Douglas Preston and Mario Spezzi, published by Grand Central Publishing. It's now available in your bookstores. And Doug, thank you for time out of a busy schedule, and we'll catch up with you down the road when the next book comes out.
All right. Well, it's great to be on the show.
Okay. Take care, Doug.
You too.
Bye-bye.